and welcome to Baseball Barbacast, the only baseball podcast in the world that knows that the real winner of the Kyrie Irving trade is Jacob DeGrom, who finally gets to hang out with his best friend again after 3 months apart. I'm Jake Mintz. That's Jordan Schusterman. Did you know that, Jordan, that they went to synagogue together when they were kids?
DeGrom
and Kyrie?
Yeah, they're definitely going to get along, I'm sure, spend all kinds of time together. No, we are the only podcast being recorded on this February 6th that's not going to talk about the Kyrie trade, although we just did, which just, I mean, I'm already disappointed in you. Jake, we have baseball to talk about. We have, actually, no, we don't. Nothing's happened since we last recorded, but we have come up with some topics that we are quite excited to get into. We're going to lead with one, Fernando Tatis Jr. Ever heard of him? We've talked about him a good amount on this podcast before. A couple moves that we'll hit on. Carlos Beltran, he's getting hired by the Mets again. We'll see if he sticks around this time. Miggy Rowe got an extension. We're going to do the scrap heap free agent draft. Is that a disrespectful term for the free agents left? Yes, but also accurate. And then we will do an email, and then we will do some dead ball Mad Libs, which I'm very excited about. Then we'll say goodbye and say have a good week. But Jake, we are going to begin with Fernando Tatis Jr., a man who will play baseball this year, hopefully, something that did not happen last year, except for those two minor league games. Remember that? That was weird. But Fernando Tatis Jr. is on our mind, and not just because he's one of the most talented baseball players we've ever seen, but because his face, his smiling face, was all over our timeline over the weekend. And it was an uncommon sight because of his situation. Because from what I can recall, in the last 10 years or so of the baseball internet plus baseball players being suspended for a variety of things. Now, obviously, there are situations where players are suspended for horrible, horrible things that obviously teams are not going to acknowledge them publicly. But in the case of steroid suspensions, which we are going to get into with Fernando Tatis Jr., what is often the case is the team acknowledges that the player is suspended, and then they are not exactly talking about them or pushing them publicly as faces of the team until their suspension is over, and then they slowly welcome them back into the fold. This is the opposite of what has been happening with Fernando Tatis Jr., as he, along with his teammates Manny Machado and Juan Soto and new teammates Xander Bogaerts and all the Padres, were in San Diego for what looked to be one of the most fun fan fests we have seen in some time. And we wanted to kind of talk about how this makes us feel that Fernando Tatis Jr. is just out and about and just like, I'm still the star here, and the Padres are like, we still love this guy, and how we feel about it.
Let me go through the timeline. Let me refresh the timeline, because that, I think, is important just to really understand. So Fernando Tatis Jr., 2020 and 2021, one of the most dynamic, entertaining, exhilarating baseball things that we have seen in quite some time, becomes kind of the future face of the game. He is on the cover of MLB The Show, 2021. People are buying his jersey. I had a Little League dad ask if he could borrow some Padres stuff so that his wife could dress up as Tatis for Halloween. Like, we were reaching this point of fame. March 2020, he gets wrist surgery after he falls off a motorcycle during the offseason. When asked about the motorcycle accident, he says, which one? Never good. Should always know which one, even if there were multiple. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's kind of a funny line that he said, which one? But
it's become less funny. It's become both more funny and more serious as the time has gone on.
You can keep that joke in the writer's room next time. So he rehabs over the course of the season, and in August of 2022 starts playing rehab games for the San Antonio Missions, the Padres AA affiliate. And it's like, holy shit, Tatis is going to be back for September and could really help the Padres make a deep run. August 12th, 2022, while I am drunk on Lake Champlain in Vermont at my friend's rehearsal dinner for his wedding, I get a notification on my phone. Fernando Tatis Jr., positive for Clostebol, a banned substance. Then Tatis tries to lie about it, mixes up Clostebol and Clostebolol or whatever the fuck. Ringworm gate happens. And I have never been more disappointed in my life to not actively have a podcast, which was the case for us at that time. Then he is suspended for the remainder of 2022. The Padres make that deep run into the postseason, and now he has 20 more games of a suspension to serve before he can return. And we are left with an incredibly bizarre situation where this beloved player who MLB was pumping money and resources into to make him the future face of the sport is just in a weird zone. And I think it is important to understand, right, that Tatis is going to be fine in San Diego. And I think that is what we learned over the weekend at their fan fest.
Yeah. And to be clear, in case anyone was listening to my intro and thinking that we were going to be like, no, he must repent further. He must stay in the shadows. He must, you know, figure out his full levels of discipline and understand what he's done wrong and stay away from his humans. He doesn't get to celebrate with all of these fans for and all the vibes because no, he was part of the reason why their season, at least to some degree, I mean, yes, I know they still made a deep postseason run, but there is still a very legitimate argument that said that he is a big part of the reason why they came up short last year, right? Like you could still make that argument, absolutely. And yet, as far as we could tell, everyone's like, hell yeah, Fernando Tatis Jr., you will be back soon. You are going to be part of one of the most exciting teams in baseball. And the vibes in San Diego, because of the offseason that they had, which included adding Xander Bogaerts, and the high of still having traded for Juan Soto, right? Obviously, they got to watch him play for the Padres already, but this was their opportunity for the fans to really formally kind of welcome Juan Soto into San Diego in this sense. They're just like, no, like we're not going to let that ruin this. But it's really the team's choice that I do think is interesting is that this is the team seemingly saying, this is how we think it is best for Fernando to move forward is to embrace him and to not act like he is. Like clearly they have dealt with him behind closed doors. I'm sure that his teammates, whether it's Musgrove, whether it's Machado, like he knows he fucked up, right? Duh, right? He knows he's fucked up at multiple points along the way. And he also realizes, fortunately, I'm still 24 years old and still have more than enough time, especially on my, you know, bajillion dollar contract that I still have with the Padres to still make this my home where they will love me. Now, it helps when you're one of the best players in the league and these fans are so excited to have him back playing for them as soon as possible. But I do think that was my takeaway is how the Padres are willing to kind of bring him back even before he's back.
There are like in my head, three buckets of people he needs or needed to win back over. They're the fans in San Diego, they're his teammates, and they're the baseball fans beyond just mm-hmm. Southern California, right? Mm-hmm. He is fine in San Diego already. It is what I would call the perfect storm of forgiveness, right? Mm-hmm. Home fans will always seek to forgive and will bend themselves into knots to try and create a narrative so that their brains can enjoy fun baseball players. And this happens across the league, across sports, like fans are biased. And I'm not saying Padres fans are different than any other fan base. Like that's a natural thing. You want to find a way to root for the guy wearing the uniform of your favorite team. So there's that. There's the fact that he is outrageously attractive and charismatic and fun to watch just stand.
Exist,
right? Yep, that makes it very easy. There's mm-hmm. the fact that he did do the camera apology and sat down and owned up to it as much as he possibly could after he lied about it, obviously. Mm-hmm. But there's the fact that the vibes in San Diego right now are so good because of all the moves they've done. Mm-hmm. And I just think that that's not going to be a problem for him at all. As far as his teammates in San Diego, it seems that that took a little bit more time, mm-hmm. that he has, though, done the work they see as necessary. He's working with Musgrove in the offseason. He seemed fine with Machado on stage. Now, I'm sure that there may be some sticky points as this goes on. I don't think we're done. I don't think it's all smooth sailing from here. But as far as when he gets back on the field in 2022, he's fine. Then, Jordan, there is the beyond. And that is what I am most interested in, is how baseball fans across the country who are not Padres fans but were interested and compelled by Fernando Tatis Jr., this dynamo, this typhoon of talent, of joy, of baseball wonder, how will they now treat him after he tested positive and was suspended?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm fascinated by that. And I know Tatis was asked already over the weekend, you know, are you thinking about getting booed? But I think that was in the context of Padres fans. And if the reception that he got was any sign, I think it's what you just said. It's that the fans, Padres fans, I'm sure there are some that are still disappointed and frustrated with how it impacted their 2022 season. But looking forward, because there's still so much to be excited about, it's not like they missed their window last year. Like, all these guys are still on the team. They're still going to be awesome, whatever. Padres fans are fine. I am curious about this, right? And if you compare it to, you know, obviously it's different than the Astros where teams feel like they were cheated. But I think it's twofold. There's one, it's that some people don't like cheaters no matter what and will boo anyone that took steroids, whether it was some level of steroids, some level, how much it helped them, we don't know. But there is definitely a subsect of baseball fans that will, a combination, dislike the fact that he cheated slash was suspended for steroids, whether that was cheating, how you define cheating or not. And two, look at his unbelievable start to his career because he got suspended for steroids, skeptically, and wonder how good he really is, how good he really was, et cetera, et cetera. And if he doesn't come back and is just as good as he was the whole time, that's another thing that's going to kind of bring the Tatis thing into a different light, which I think for us is a little goofy. I think we, you know, wholeheartedly believe in the talent that is within here. But admittedly, yeah, like there's also part of it's like, well, okay, he had the best starts to a career of all time. Do we think he was juicing the whole time? I don't believe that. But there are people that easily, once you get suspended once, you've lost their trust forever. That is a large group of baseball fans that we have to acknowledge.
I do think, though, that is an older group of baseball fans. Sure. And kind of,
that's a lot of baseball fans.
Ah, good point, Jordan. I think that the younger generation of fans are more willing to forget and forgive if the sin you committed was not, you know, truly horrible on, you know, the scale of immorality.
Sure.
He did not actively harm the life of another person. He did something dumb at a young age. And personally, like, I'm inclined to forgive and forget. The narrative that I have swirling around my head is he gets hurt. He wants to come back quicker. He takes the goop and that's what he tests positive and then he gets suspended. And in my mind, I am willing to believe that we have not seen him benefit from the cheating, right? Now, maybe that's a convenient narrative that I'm crafting because I want to celebrate this fun player. And I'm also willing to admit that. And that's why I think this is really interesting. I think what helps Tatis is how young he is and how good he is and how likable he is. And when you compare him to the two other big cheating things that we've had in the last like 10 years, and for me, that's the Astros and that's A-Rod, right? Mm-hmm. A-Rod gets suspended for a whole year at the end of his career, okay? And by that point, like the die was cast, right? Like A-Rod was a thing. He was despised. He was a Yankee. He was hated. He was not liked. And so him cheating kind of confirmed all these things that people wanted to see and believe and project onto A-Rod, right? Mm-hmm. Whereas Tatis still has time to do 15 years worth of amazing, likable baseball shit and change people's minds about him. Mm-hmm. A-Rod never got the opportunity to do that. And I don't think really would have necessarily. Mm-hmm. And then, like, the other one is the Astros and Correa, right? Where there was such an obvious victim of those, you know, of that malfeasance, where it was really easy as a Dodgers fan to be like, you cheated us out of this thing. No one really lost from the Tatis cheating besides his teammates, right?
And if like, anything, the teams like the Phillies and the teams that played the Padres and the, you know, the postseason, I know they ended up beating the Mets, whatever. We're like, oh, great. You don't have Fernando Tatis Jr.? Awesome. Sounds good to me.
So I just find it to be a very different and unique scenario that he's finding himself in.
I agree with that. Here's the other thing I'll say, kind of circling back to the kind of regaining the trust. The other thing we have to remember with him as we bring back up the multiple motorcycle accidents. And also, we had already seen, you know, in 2021 at times, some discord between Machado and Tatis. And I'm sure that that's like, you know, big brother, little brother type shit, right? And Tatis feeling like I'm the coolest person in the world. And Machado's like, hello, I'm Manny Machado. What are we talking about? And we saw that. And so that's the thing I'm interested in too. Like beyond even the steroid stuff and lying about it and all the goofy, embarrassing stuff that for me just made me disappointed in him as like a young person trying to figure this stuff out. I was just like, dude, why are you being such a dummy? Like that's the part that I would just like to see him figure out. Even beyond the steroid stuff, because there was enough of those examples when you talk about the motorcycle stuff and then the lying about, like, that's the stuff that I would am most hopeful that he can figure out how to be more reasonable about, right? On the field, I am not concerned. This guy is one of the most talented people, baseball players you've ever seen. And I think that obviously we are fully in favor of the way that he plays the game. Duh, we don't have to explain that. But I just hope that he has learned also through all of this mess, through a whole year of missed games, through a suspension, through multiple injuries that he played through kind of stubbornly, that he has also dealt with injuries over the offseason. All of these are hopefully good signs towards maturity, right? And who are we to be saying, oh, I hope this guy matures? But I want it for the selfish standpoint of, I want this guy to be on the field. I want this guy to be on the field, whether it's because he's healthy, whether it's because he's following the rules, whether it's because he's, you know, like all these different things. I just want him to be playing. And part of that is clearly going to be him figuring out how to just not be a dummy. So in multiple ways. And so that is what I'm hopeful for.
Maybe this is an ominous note to finish on. Mm-hmm. But above Fernando Tatis's head, wherever he goes for this season, Jordan, and the rest of his career, there will be a ghost, a figure of another member of the 2022 San Diego Padres. And that is Robinson Cano, who I'm sure you forgot played for the 2022 San Diego Padres. Yeah. But Cano cheated once and people were like, ooh, I don't like that. And then he came back for the Mets and like he was pretty good for a little bit, right? And people were like, oh, Robinson Cano, we're willing to forgive. And then he got popped again. And once you get popped again, fool me once, shame on you, fool me twice, shame on me. He's skating on thin ice. And that's the thing to remember. See, if he is, to me, in my head right now, a guy who cheated. He is not a cheater. And there maybe is a difference there. And I'm, you know, picking my words carefully. But for me, he is a guy who cheated. He is not a cheater. He is not a serial cheater. He is a young dummy who cheated, right? He cheats again.
Now
we're going to have some problems.
Exactly. But all everything I just said too, right? I hope that, and honestly, for a person in Cano who he's very familiar with, and you could say that's a good thing or a bad thing, like these are things that I would hope he has gotten every possible lesson along the way to get back on the no longer being a dummy path so that he can hopefully play. I know he's not going to play a full season this year, but that in 2024, hopefully he can play, you know, 160 games and be one of the best players in the league.
Last question for you, Jordan. Does Fernando Tatis Jr. get booed in 2024? Because I think he will definitely get booed from place to place here this season. That's obvious. Does he get booed Padres' first away game in 2024?
Yes, but just mostly for the reasons that, like, the best players on the best teams get booed. If we're putting in the category of he's getting, categorizing boos, but I think still generally yes. And like, again, he's still the kind of guy that is, he's going to get booed in Dodger Stadium his whole career. And that's how it's going to work for good players in the NL West that are on the Dodgers. And that's fine. And he's just the same way Acuna gets booed, right? Now he's sometimes players are so popular and so overwhelmingly popular that they get cheered everywhere. And Otani. I think Otani, right? Juan Soto probably reached that level too.
But Tatis was on that level. That's kind of
for
my
sure.
point. That's where
for sure.
that was the trajectory.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he can get back on that trajectory. It's just going to take more time.
Yeah, I think you're right. But yeah, Dodgers fans, again, they have always nice to have another guy that they can do.
Right. There's no Dodgers fans being like, it's time to forgive.
No, that's not happening anytime soon. Now, the other thing about this Tatis thing, just the weekend, is it's just a concept of fan fest. And I wanted to spend a little bit of time on this pod talking about fan fest and talking about the off-season activity where players on their where teams send their players out in front of their fans as a way of kind of getting ready excited for the season. It's interesting when certain teams choose to do this. Some of them kind of make it about the winter and they do like X winter fest, and it's like, oh, like we're cold, but hey, like let's come have some fun and come see a bunch of your favorite baseball players. And then there's a concept of the caravan, which we saw the Orioles doing. We know our guest last week, Grayson Rodriguez, we saw, he told us he was about to go on that. And you probably saw some videos of him and Adley, a bunch of the Orioles around the Baltimore area doing what is called a caravan. Now, these are two slightly different things. Now, not every team does these in the offseason, which I think is interesting. As some people, I've seen people on Twitter like, well, why don't the Yankees do this? And I'm like, well, because the Yankees don't have to do this because they have their fans are going to show up no matter what. They don't have to drum up interest.
Yeah, it's like, oh man, we got to make sure people are going to go to the Yankees games.
At the same time, like it is such a fan-friendly thing that I love. And I love that the shitty teams do this too and the fans show out. And I think that that's really cool. And the reason why I love caravans versus FanFest is that they'll go to just these really random places. And like, you'll look, I'm always fascinated by this. Like, here's the tour, right? We're going to go take a bunch of our players on a bus for a week and go around the area to these like random middle schools and random breweries and towns you've never heard of and show up with a bunch of big leaguers. That's like so old school. It feels like something that used to happen decades ago. And that I love that we still do that now.
Yeah.
Where the Reds are like rolling into random towns in Kentucky and like showing up, you know, at some I love that. Like it feels like a kind of a something from an old era, but I love that it is still kind of accepted for a lot of these organizations as a way to connect to fans. And I love that. But there are some quirks to it too, which also are very entertaining.
Well, there's, you know, let's just talk about what the Padres did versus what the Orioles did, because I do think that these teams are in relatively similar vibe spots. Now, obviously the payrolls are different and the Padres are going to be better than the Orioles. That's not
but there is excitement for the season,
right?
More there's than buzz. Most teams.
Yes. There's buzz. And so the Padres were like, we're doing this at Petco. Everyone come out. And they had 48,000 people show up to Petco and, Park for this.
Yes. And of course, people are showing that the difference is, oh, well, look at the difference between the 2015 Fan Fest and the 2023 Fan Fest. Yeah, duh. You think people were losing their shit to go out and be like, oh, Jed Jerko's playing second this year. I got to go show him some love. And, well, we got Will Venable and Corey Spangenberg and James Shields is our ace. Like, hey, you know, it's cooler than James Shields, the guy you're going to trade him for. That is the excitement. And when you, of course, that's why the Padres are going to post a bunch of pictures of Bogarts and Machado and Soto Tatis together. Like if you're a fan, like you're losing your mind. You're wanting to buy tickets as soon as possible. You're trying to get out to the park as many times as possible. And that's when people are asking, how is this sustainable? How does this work? Well, because people are going to be buying Padres stuff all season long, including tickets, including merch, including all these things. That's how you make the money back. It's not that complicated.
It's not bandwagoning if it's way better now. Like, you know, right. It's like, oh yeah, I saw this horrible movie and I have to stay loyal to it. Like, why would you want to go see the 2015 Padres? I wouldn't have. No way. But like, you want to go see this team and you're excited about it. So there's that, which was an incredible scene to see all those people out. Versus the Orioles, who are bringing their guys to random places in like Maryland and Pennsylvania, whatever. And what I love about what the Orioles are doing is that you can envision Tatis in Petco Park, right? Like on a stage or, you know, Bogarts on the field. But the idea of like Adley Rutschman in an elementary school or Ryan Mountcastle in a brewery is so like simple and humanizing to me that it is such an easy way to drum up interest and support.
Hey, give credit to the Padres. They did a whole community thing last week where Juan Soto was showing up in elementary school. So, but I agree with you. Like, it is just, it's such a, you know, I feel like during the season, sometimes we'll just get like these viral moments where guys will show up at a school or show up for like a special guest appearance. And yet during these events, it's like, oh yeah, of course. Like I suddenly see on my timeline, here's like a bunch of people on the Rangers just like sitting in a high school gym, like, oh, okay. Like, it's like, but I love that. And I don't know, like there's something about it. And truly maybe the Yankees don't need to do it because people are going to lose their mind anyway. I know there are some smaller market teams that aren't doing Fan Fest, and I think that sucks. And I think that it is something that is so obviously able to put on. And even the teams, Yes, I know we're talking about, okay, why would you be excited about the 2015 Padres? But also, this is also a place where if you bring your prospects, people will lose their mind. And that is something that we've seen, especially for the Cubs. I think the Cubs Fest, now I know they just signed a bunch of cool big leaguers, but seeing the stuff from Cubs Con or whatever they call it, like people are freaking out for Matt Mervis and PCA, right? And Brennan Davis. And like these, like there is, like people want to be excited about the team no matter what Fangraphs says, how many wins they're going to have, right? This is the time of year for that. And so it's just disappointing to see teams not taking advantage of those opportunities, because the reality is there are fans for every team and there are fans that will show up and support. And it's just cool scenes.
What do you think they call like the national convention for like ceiling fans? Do you think they call that Fan Fest?
Right. I don't know. I mean, that does probably exist, right? Ceiling fan makers. Is that worthy of a national convention? Probably. There's national conventions for a lot of stuff. Great question. I do not have the answer for you. Okay. Anyway, we love Fan Fest and we hope that they continue to happen. And we hope that the caravans continue to take major league players into random towns across America. A couple bits of news before we take a break. The Dodgers, according to our good friend Daniel Alvarez, former guest of the podcast, have signed Miguel Rojas to an extension, a little two-year extension. And I just want to talk about this quickly because I, first and foremost, am overjoyed for Miguel Rojas, who has been playing on and has been the face of the Marlins over the last few years, which is great, because he's awesome and was perfect for that team, but he was not winning a lot of baseball games. And I love that he's now got, he finally got paid, which is cool. That's, he's had a long career where he has not gotten an extension or any sort of secure, guarantee like this. And now he gets just to be like the number one bench player for one of the best teams in baseball, where of course he started his career. And I'm just very, very happy for Miggy Rowe. And I think he is exactly the kind of guy you would want around to have around. He's perfect insurance for if, you know, Outman, Vargas, you know, Michael Busch, Lux, like if any of those guys fall on their face, it's like, oh, well, good, we have Miguel Rojas. Like, he's just a better version of Hanser Alberto.
I love that they've done this because he hasn't even played a game or hung out with anybody yet, right? Like, you're signing this guy in part because he is just a solid guy to have around.
His reputation is so good that it's just like, you haven't even been here yet? Like, yes, please.
Amazing.
But yes, but he was also, and I know he was at the Dodgers Fan Fest. I can imagine that was a little bit different than what he's experienced with the Marlins in recent years. With respect to the Marlins fans, we love you. One other interesting bit of news, which is that Carlos Beltran, Carlos Beltran getting hired by the Mets as a manager is a piece of news and information that I have to remind myself happened every once in a while. But after that fell apart for reasons we don't have to review, he has since then kind of was off the radar, wasn't really around. And then this past year was in the Yes booth, was on some Yankees games. Did you ever get to watch any of those games? It's felt like he did not really deliver much on those broadcasts.
He was not a fit. I think that he is particularly skilled at communicating with baseball players, which is a different skill than communicating with regular human beings like us.
I would agree. And so, it's always interesting when we assume that guy's going to be great on a broadcast. And this seemed to be more of one like, he's a brilliant baseball mind, put him on a broadcast, and it just didn't really translate. And it's likely, as we knew, because he was trying to get hired originally, that he wanted to work in baseball, not, you know, on TV for baseball. And so it appears that he's been hired to return to the Mets, I guess, again, to be some sort of special assistant to Billy Epler. And it's cool. Makes sense. Good. I'm glad he's back in. I don't know. Like, I'm curious to what degree if he is going to become, you know, how important he's going to become for Epler. But, you know, makes sense. I don't see anything wrong with this. I guess I'm just surprised that the Yankees wouldn't just want to retain him in that role. But who knows?
It's a very obvious headline, right? Mm-hmm. Guy who had long career, was manager, was embroiled in cheating scandal, then wasn't manager, will now work for baseball team. Mm-hmm. However, I think it's unfortunately a lot more boring than that. I think he's just smart and people want to have him around. And I do think he will do real work for the Mets internally. And we won't know that much about it. And then he'll get into the Hall of Fame in 4 years and whatever.
I agree. I will say, like I said, though, I'm sure Steve Cohen just offered him way more than whatever the Yankees were going to offer him to do the same job. Like, that's like, I feel very comfortable saying that. By the way, I don't know if you saw the Steve Cohen, Jeff Passan interview today. Maybe we'll save that for later this week. That was pretty interesting. Steve Cohen just being like, yep, I'm just going to keep doing my thing. You can't stop me. I'm playing within the rules. And if you're mad about it, that's a you problem. We love to hear it. And Mets fans love to hear it as well. All right. We are going to take a quick break. And we come back, we are going to draft the superstar laden free agents remaining for our all-star free agent teams.
Negro Leagues Baseball Museum President Bob Kendrick hosts the SiriusXM original podcast, Black Diamonds.
The Negro Leagues didn't care what color you were, and they didn't care what gender you were. Can you play?
Hear stories of the leagues and legends that shaped sport, culture, and society.
That's why the museum is so important. It's like, we are never going to forget you.
Episodes of the award-winning Black Diamonds are now available wherever you get your podcasts.
We're not talking about balls and strikes. We're talking about your life.
And welcome back to Baseball Barbacast. I'm Jake Mintz. That's Jordan Schusterman. You know, sometimes, Jordan, you go thrifting and you look for diamonds in the rough for your wardrobe. And that is what we are going to do here today. This offseason was built as a hell of a free agent class, but those guys are scooped up. And so what we're going to do here today is sift through the dregs. We are going to go... Dumpster diving is probably too harsh. I won't say that, but I just did. And we are going to draft the remaining players on the free agent market. We are going to build teams, and we are going to laugh about them. Anything else, Jordan?
Yeah, I mean, you know, at the start of the offseason, you put together the all-free agent team, and you said, oh, would this team win 120 games? Well, we're going to do it now, and we're going to ask, would this team win 20 games? Jake, you have the first pick. We're just going to go back and forth. We're not going to go snake. Again, we're building out a team plus DH. We're going to go through this pretty quickly. One starting pitcher, one reliever. And this is also just serve as a reminder for who's still out there. That's the other reason why we're doing this. So, Jake, you have the first pick. Who's going 1-1 in the scrap heap February 6th free agent draft?
Why do I get the first pick? Are you implying that you had a better 2022 than me?
Damn right. Damn right I am. So you're up first.
You did get engaged. Yeah, Jordan got engaged in 2022. And so
No. It was a lottery, and you just won the lottery. It was a coin flip lottery, and you won the lottery. Congratulations.
I will take Gary Sanchez with the first overall pick.
Damn, okay.
He has gone from the thing we talk about the most on baseball Twitter to Minnesota purgatory, and now he's a free agent. And I think that there's a little bit left in the bat. He will never return to the heights he once reached as a member of the Yankees. And the reason I'm taking him first overall is that the gap between him and the other catchers available is massive. And I did not want to end up with either Kevin Plawecki or Robinson Chirinos, both of whom were worth negative 1.2 WAR in 2022. Gary was a 0.9 win player, which is positive. I mean, he can help a team.
Yeah, that's the right pick. I was going to take him first as well. So now I'm regretting giving you the first pick. With my first pick, I am going to take Jerickson Profar. There are some other outfield options, which we're going to get to. But again, if I'm just trying to, you know, kind of raise the floor for my crappy free agent team, he's as safe as it gets. He will likely be playing left field for my squad. Who you got?
I will take Michael Wacha, who I think is far and away the best pitcher available. Mm-hmm. Best starting pitcher. I am surprised he's still out there, mm-hmm. and that he could maybe even get a 2-year deal. Like, he was pretty good for the Red Sox last
year. Yeah. No, it's a weird one. He's had a very strange career, but I would imagine he would be getting a deal by now. So
according to Baseball Reference, last year by WAR was the best year of his career. Mm-hmm. He was a 3.3 win pitcher.
That was the best year of his career?
Correct.
According to WAR. That is crazy. What was earlier with the Cardinals? It had to be at least 2.5 or 3.
He had a 1.27 ERA plus in 127 innings. Love that.
Damn. All right. Well, that is a good pick. And the drop-off for there, I don't like any of the other starting pitchers. But I'm going to take Elvis Andrus for my shortstop. There are some other interesting shortstop positions. But again, the ceiling here, I mean, Andrus was, talk about bounce back, one of the better years of his career. I will happily take Elvis at shortstop. Also weird that he is still out there.
Didn't they make a movie about him last year?
I believe they did, yes.
I think that was about him. Good pick, Jordan. And I will go with David Peralta just to get an outfielder on the board. Peralta, I think by Fangraphs War, was the second most valuable player, position player, free agent still remaining behind Profar. He is not the hitter he once was. However, he did get the ball in the air like way more than he ever had in his entire career. And he's still just a solid big league player. I would imagine he'll find his way on a contender.
I am going to take Luke Voit. I'm taking him now. Speaking of getting the ball in the air, I mean, again, toughest bounce in trade deadline history, getting shipped to the Nationals, but he ultimately does end up on the free agent market, which I thought would be a good thing. And yet now we're sitting here in you know, early February and he can't find a team. I don't know if I'm going to put him at DH or first yet, but I definitely would like to pick him up as I think the highest ceiling bat remaining of any of these guys. So I'm taking him.
Great. I will then take Yuli Gurriel just to make sure I have someone who can hit the baseball consistently. Gurriel definitely fell off a cliff a little bit last year and finally looks to be showing his age, which is almost, he will turn 39 in June. But he's still a solid defensive first baseman, and he's still not horrible, and definitely worth having around. He has a skill set that you would imagine will age pretty decently and has so far. I mean, he won the batting title in 2021. Like, he hit 319 in 2021. I think he's still got some juice left.
Totally fair. I am going to take Matt Moore here as my reliever. There are some interesting relievers left, and you could argue maybe he's not the best one, but he's definitely the one coming off the best season with an ERA, I think, under two in, what, like 70 innings. I am very surprised as a left-handed reliever who's that durable and that kind of pedigree. I am very surprised he is still out there. And honestly, I also would like Matt Moore for length because I know my starting pitcher is going to suck. So I need to make sure that he can kind of give me multiple innings out of the bullpen. So I'm taking Matt Moore as my first reliever. Pedigree, as my only reliever. Yeah.
Pedigree is a hilarious thing to use for Matt Moore because his pedigree is that he was the alongside Trout and Harper, the three best prospects in baseball. Is that pedigree? I don't know. I will take Edwin Rios, formerly of the Los Angeles.
I was really
Dodgers.
Hoping I could sneak him to my next pick. That hurts.
Nope. Edwin Rios was very injured last year. He only played in 27 games, 92 plate appearances, but in that time was like pretty good, hit 7 home runs in 92 plate appearances, which is a really good rate. He has always hit for the Dodgers. He's just battled a lot of injuries. He can play the outfield. He can play first base. He can DH, powerful lefty bat. I would, if I was betting like remainder career war of anyone on this list, he'd be number one.
Wow. Okay. That is a great pick. I'm mad that I could not get him later. I will save my starting pitcher for the end because I'm not excited about any of them and you already have one. So I am going to, now we're getting kind of tight here. I'm going to take Robbie Grossman is going to be who I'm going to take. I'm going to take him for his switch hitting, his on-base ability. Now, listen, It got pretty bad last year. He was not very good in 2022, but his track record for being like comfortably above average offensively, particularly because of that on-base ability, was there for multiple years before last year. He's only 33. Put him in the outfield. I think there's a decent floor there for Robbie Grossman. Taking Robbie Grossman.
When he got traded to the Braves at the deadline, it was like, here's Jock Peterson, 2022. And then he
not
was quite.
He was only a little bit better than he was with the Tigers. But I just believe that he's not. He was really good in 2021. So I'm taking Grossman.
I will take Rougned Odor for the fucking vibes, baby.
Okay. All right. So is he playing second?
Yeah, he's playing second for me. Rugi is not good at baseball anymore. He was worth -0.4 B war. He did hit 13 home runs and was like, not terrible offensively at around an 80 OPS plus, but he just did so much stuff for the 2022 Orioles. Like, he was around and he was always there and he was always bald. And so for my team, I want him in the clubhouse.
I am going to take Jonathan Villar with my next pick. Now he's also in the Robbie Grossman category of actually like pretty decent in 2021 and then like cataclysmically terrible in 2022. I'm picking him because I think he is a sneaky, could get up to most franchises played, especially among position players. He's already at 8 and now 9 as he joins my free agent squad. He's only 32. I just feel like he could, he's very versatile defensively still, and he's obviously still fast. He's giving me some flexibility here, and I'm taking VR. He might really suck, but I'm taking VR.
I'm going to take Jose Iglesias as my shortstop. Mm-hmm. Once you took Andrews, it was kind of Iglesias, then a big gap. Not interested in employing Didi Gregorius in the year of our Lord 2023, because holy fucking yikes. Iglesias did what Iglesias does last year. He played decent defense that looks really cool. And he hit for a high batting average with absolutely no power. Even in Coors Field for the Rockies, in 439 at-bats, he hit 3 homers. He did hit 292. So he's my shortstop.
I am going to go boring but safe and take Donovan Solano here, mostly because him and VR, second and third, can basically be either way. And I feel better about that than certainly than signing Robinson Cano or getting any of the shortstops left and having them play third, because Andrews is clearly the best option there. So I feel pretty good about sneaking Solano to me here, because I wasn't sure how interested you were going to be in VR, and that's why I kind of jumped up and grabbed him. And Solano is a much safer bet, you know, 97 OPS plus in over 300 plate appearances in 2022. He's a little bit older, so maybe he falls off a cliff, but Solano, much more stable than VR, so I like that pick.
Dansby Swanson is not on this list, but his doppelganger is, and I'm going to take him, Charlie Culberson, mostly because there are absolutely no third basemen available out there in the world, and I just need one. He's fine, I guess. Like, he wasn't.
Much, I have no sense for how much he played last year.
Take a guess. How many plate appearances?
Say 85.
124 for the Texas Rangers, but appeared in 68 games, so I imagine he came in quite a bit defensively. 83 OPS plus, useful player who will go down in baseball history forever for the walk-off homer he had in Vin Scully's final game.
Oh, well said. Okay, I need another outfielder. I think, oh my God, I'm actually going to take JBJ.
Fuck!
Because I need a center field defense, and I guess there's another option or two here, but I feel like now my outfield defense is pretty good with Profar, Grossman, and JBJ. And listen, the JBJ trade was not a success for the Boston Red Sox, but for this purposes of this draft, I am perfectly happy to take him on a minimum and just say, hey, go bat ninth and play center field for me.
That's a great pick. I really should have taken him a pick ago. Mm-hmm. And that is because there are no other outfield defenders on this list.
There's one more that's I mean, my outfield set, so I can say it now. But, I mean, Naquin plays center.
Did play center, but I'm going by Fangraph's defensive rankings. Bradley was the only...
Oh, doing some research. Your draft board is shaking up. Okay.
Yeah. I mean, Bradley was the only positive outfield defender. No one else is positive. Ben Gamble, who's on this list, who actually hit a decent amount, awful in center field. Just terrible.
Yeah, so he's terrible in center. Yeah.
Yeah. I will take Naquin to play center field for me. Your pick.
Okay. All right.
Naquin traded to the Mets last year, halfway through the year. Did play a decent amount for them. 334 plate appearances after a hot start with the Reds. we talked about hunting a lot.
He did. Okay, just because it's fun, I think I'm going to take Franmil Reyes as my DH. Now, he also is a candidate for like in Korea by the middle of the year, but he is young enough to where I'm still hoping that I don't really know what his future is. Like, he ended up on the Cubs and was like a little bit better than how terrible he was to start the year in Cleveland. But I love Franmil, and he will be my DH. I'd rather have him than Miguel Sano. So he's my DH.
Yeah, that's probably a good pick. Now that I'm staring Miguel Sano in the face,
your other option is to put Rios at DH and then just pick Gamble. I would probably feel like that might be the move. But
I'm gonna take Ben Gamble and put Edwin Rios at DH, which is an idea that just popped into my own head. Ben Gamble was with the Pirates last year. played in 115 games. Oh, yeah. My God.
Love Ben
Gamble. But he was an average big league hitter and looks like Steve the Pirate from Dodgeball.
So what is your outfield arrangement? I guess it's Gamble. Gamble. So Peralta in left, Naquin in center, and Gamble in right?
Yeah.
That seems pretty solid. Okay. Now you then you have Rios at DH. I think you still have a infielder to get, but I'm going to go ahead with my next selection. I'm going to take Robinson Chirinos. Now, Robinson Chirinos certainly has no use offensively anymore, but I like the lineup I've built, and I know that he was at least some level of helpful influence in kind of guiding the Orioles pitching staff to competency and beyond in 2022, and I'd rather have him than Kevin Plawecki. So, Robinson Chirinos, you are my catcher.
With my final pick, I believe I only need a relief pitcher, and
yes.
I will take, yikes, this is a tough group. I will take Zach Britton to bounce back in 2023. He threw like one inning, like four pitches, and then walked off the mound with a hurt arm after he came back from TJ. I just like, he was the greatest relief pitcher we've ever seen for 3 months. How can I not draft that guy?
So your take, a lot of great injury options here. I mean, Alex Reyes is here. Archie Bradley is here. Michael Fulmer was like pretty good and then hurt. Knebel, just he had surgery too. Chafin's great. I mean, Chafin to me,
Chafin is really close. Good.
Yeah, but you just love Zach Britton. I understand that.
Chafin is a free agent?
Yeah, dude. I've been telling the Mariners to sign him for two straight fucking years, and they just won't do it. Huh. So I don't know. They just would keep rather picking up guys off on waivers. I don't understand. Chafin and Moore. I don't get it. And Will Smith is another good lefty reliever still out there. So very weird. I don't understand those at all. All right, my final pick and which starting pitcher. Here's who I'm choosing from just before you yet laugh at me for making a pick. I'm choosing between Michael Pineda, Chris Archer, Dylan Bundy, Chase Anderson, Dallas Keuchel, Cole Hamels, Mike Minor, Anibal Sanchez, and David Price. Is he retired yet? Who knows? I have always had a soft spot for Big Mike, and I'm going to take Big Mike because I guess the upside pick here would be Archer or Bundy, but... I don't know. I just love Big Mike. I think he's still big. He's still big. He's still Mike.
Yep.
He was really, really bad in 11 starts. I'm already reconsidering my selection. I probably should take Bundy. Who would you take here? Would you take Bundy?
Yeah, I would take Bundy by a mile. I mean, here's the thing with Big Mike.
Yeah, it's got to be Bundy. Bundy's got to be my pick. I'm sorry. It's Bundy.
Big Mike is so big. He's so Mike. He's 6'7", 280 pounds. He's 34, and he was bad on the Tigers. So yeah. I'm willing to let
no,
that
it's
ship
Bundy.
Sail.
It's Bundy. Bundy's my pick. Big Mike. I had forgotten. I was still kind of riding off the magic of 2021 Big Mike, who was like stunningly competent. And so because of that, I've clouded how bad he was in just 11 starts. I also thought he made more starts for the Tigers. So. Bundy is my selection. Maybe he's probably giving up a home run to Gary Sanchez in this hypothetical World Series between our two free agent teams. But I will take the stability that he can go five and dive and hand it over to Matt Moore for the last four.
Remember Dylan Bundy's 2020 season when he was absolutely fucking incredible and got Cy Young votes and then returned to pumpkin status almost immediately?
I don't, because that was in 2020 and it was for the Angels. So I do not remember that at all. But thank you for reminding me. I will. Yeah, he's only 30, right? So that's the other reason I feel like Bundy, you know, tap into some upside there.
Here are the soldiers I'm going in a battle with. Michael Wacha getting the start. Zach Britton in the bullpen. Gary Sanchez behind the plate. Yuli Gurriel at first. Rougned Odor at second. Jose Iglesias at short. Charlie Culberson at third and an outfield of Ben Gamble, Tyler Naquin, and David Peralta with Edwin Rios as my DH.
I've got Dylan Bundy out on the bump throwing to catcher Robinson Chirinos. If only Dylan Bundy had Robinson Chirinos in Baltimore. Imagine he really would have figured it out there. After Dylan Bundy he will hand the ball over to Matt Moore, who again had an ERA under 2 in over 70 innings this past season and is still available. At first base, I've got Luke Voit. Donovan Solano will play third for me with Elvis Andrus at short, Jonathan Villar at second. My outfield, Profar in left, JBJ in center, Robbie Grossman in right, with the Franimal at DH.
Who says there's no free agents left on the market? Come on.
Let us know which of these teams wins a seven-game series. How many games do each of our teams win in Major League Baseball in 2023?
Zero, because they are all getting hurt in spring training because all these guys are 34.
Very true. All right, Jake, let's do a quick email, and then we're going to do some dead ball Mad Libs to wrap us up. We received this email to, again, you can email us at baseballbarbacast@gmail.com. That is the email, baseballbarbcast@gmail.com. And this question that we received is a simple one, but one that is the category of one that I do quite enjoy debating often, because I feel like we think a lot about just like team building and kind of the team's futures and their chances for teams to succeed in the near and short term and long term. And so this is a mailbag question titled First, Worst, and Mid at Bests. This is good. He's given us three groups of five teams, asking us which will appear in a World Series first. So let us begin. Which of these, this is from Ian. Thank you, Ian. Which of these five teams will appear in a World Series first? Again, we're just talking about appear in a World Series first. Rockies, Marlins, Royals, Tigers, A's.
Rockies, Marlins, Royals, Tigers, A's. Appear in a World Series first. I will select. You want to say it at the same time and make it cute, Jordan?
Yes. Ready? Let's say it at the same time.
3, 2, 1. Tigers.
Royals. Yeah. I was going to say Tigers, and then I was like, I like Vinny Pasquantino just a little bit more than all of the Tigers. So I am going Royals just because I feel better about the roster. I think I feel similarly about the ownership, although presumably there's more history of the Tigers spending a lot more, but I'm still buying big on Propane King John Sherman. And I just feel like the Tigers roster is in such a tough spot that I could see the Royals, you know, building a good team at some point in the next 5 years or 10 years, whatever.
I don't think that matters at all where the rosters are at right now, because neither of these teams are making a World Series in the next 5 years, so it's irrelevant. Yeah, and the current general manager of the Tigers, Scott Harris, was in San Francisco under the Farhan tree, and I will reap those rewards.
It's more of a front office, long-term build away. Yeah, I think that's fair.
And the Rockies are in the NL West, so they're fucked. The Marlins
same
the,
thing in at least A's. A's who knows?
I would say in order for me, it would go Tigers, A's, Royals, Marlins, Rockies would be my.
Yeah, favorite. I think I would do A's third because they're such a wild card. because who knows what happens if presumably they are going to move and get a new owner? Who knows? Whatever. So yeah, that is an interesting one. All right, let's move to this next one. This is the opposite of the one we just asked. Which of these teams will appear in a World Series first? Yankees, Mariners, Padres, Mets, Dodgers. This is a little more short term.
Duh.
So the team we have seen most recently in the World Series of this group is the Dodgers, and then the Mets, and then a huge drop off to the Yankees, and then obviously Padres and Mariners. They don't know what the World Series is. So, Jake, what do you think?
I will take the New York Yankees, Jordan. How about you?
So you are betting on it being easier for the Yankees to get there. Is that an AL versus NL pick, kind of?
Yeah. Padres, Dodgers, Mets as a group is like one of those teams might get there, but I think like they're just going to beat each other up.
Right. Who will be there first?
I don't feel confident in picking any of those three.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So I'll take the Yankees.
Yeah, I think I agree with you. Right? Because we saw, and even with the Mets too, right? We saw how quickly a season that looks World Series bound can go, you know, suddenly you're in the wild card series and now you're fucked. All right. Like that is less likely to happen with the Yankees, I feel like, relatively. So that's, and also why, again, Mariners, just like as long as you're in the division with the Astros, I'd rather pick a team that I'm more confident winning the division.
I would go Yankees, Mets, Padres, Dodgers, Mariners, I think.
I think I would agree with you. I would do that order as well. All right, last group of five. Which of these teams will appear in World Series first? Orioles?
Yes.
That's your favorite team.
Yeah.
Why didn't you put the Mariners in this group? Maybe I'm flattered that he put the Mariners in the other group.
That's true.
Next, the Orioles here is groups. Orioles, Twins, Rangers, Brewers, Giants. This is the spiciest one by far.
This is a great group.
All right.
Let's go process of elimination here. It's not the Rangers.
It's not the Rangers. Yeah. It's not the Rangers. I was going to eliminate the Brewers, but they're in the weakest division, I think. They're in the division that's trying the least. I guess the Twins are also.
I have a Baltimore Orioles 2024 World Series championship tattoo on my left butt cheek. And so that's only a year away. And so I'll go with the Orioles.
Where do you put the Giants? I think you could make a giant argument for the Giants to be last. Is that insane?
Yeah.
It's pretty disrespectful. I would probably have them fourth. I would put Texas last. I think the Twins and Brewers are very similar because they're both pretty solid teams in winnable divisions, right? Solid teams in winnable divisions is still a good start because winning the division is just, I think, a really big part of this conversation is how likely it is I think you can win the division. That also hurts the Orioles. But I feel better about the Twins and Brewers winning a division in the next few years than honestly the Orioles and certainly the Rangers and Giants. That's why I'm saying this, because I think the division winning aspect is just so big. What do you think?
I have Orioles brand, so I need you to pick something.
No, I know. And that's why I think I would still have the Orioles, I think, definitely in the top three. I think I would go, oh my God, this is really hard. This is really, really, really hard. All right. I think I would go Orioles, Twins, Brewers, Giants, Rangers.
Orioles, Twins, Brewers, Giants, Rangers.
I'd go Brewers. Brewers over Twins. Okay. But that's a front office. Whose front office are you betting on there? That's kind of close. Yeah. What do you think?
I agree with your first one.
Okay. There you go. And he asked, does any of your chances change for winning a World Series? No, because that's just get there and then who fucking knows what's going to happen.
Point
flip. So there you go. All right, Jake, we're going to finish off with some dead ball Mad Libs. And I have brought you a player today. A player who was born. Oh, let's remind everyone what the hell this is. Can you tell us what we're about to do?
Dead ball Mad Libs. There's a lot of old stuff in baseball. A lot of it's super freaking weird. And we are going to play a game where we highlight a lot of that weird, in which one of us, in this case Jordan, reads from either a Sabre page or a Wikipedia page, takes some of the words out, and I have to guess them. Jordan, here we go.
We are going to talk about an infielder by the name of Germany Schaefer, born in 1876 in Chicago, Illinois. I will be reading from an excellent Sabre article written by Dan Holmes. Germany Schaefer, born to, you guessed it, German immigrant parents in Chicago's South Side, February 4th, 1876. And let's just start off with kind of the theme of what this is going to be. His Sabre page starts by saying, always willing to entertain the crowd, Germany Schaefer's antics as a player and coach helped pave the way for later baseball clowns. He gained his greatest notoriety for, go ahead. This is a thing you can do on the baseball field in the game.
His greatest notoriety for getting ejected.
Well, he does have some ejections, but no, for stealing first base. What does that mean? We're going to explain that a little bit later. So the thing you need to know about Germany Schaefer is this dude was just a huge goofball. Now, he didn't actually debut until 1901. He's age 25, kind of got into pro ball late. Eventually, so he's with the Cubs. That's great. And then he eventually gets traded to the Tigers, which is really where he kind of makes his known. He becomes friends with Ty Cobb, one of the few people that Ty Cobb actually liked, which is good. And I like this here. This is how one Milwaukee observer described Schaefer. All right. This is just kind of giving a sense for the kind of ball player he was. Played all three infield positions, or except for shortstop. He was a well-built chap wearing an astonishing pair of shoulders and showed rare speed and fighting ability. Fighting ability. All right, sure. Now,
which
I'm
was
going
a
to
huge, huge thing in old baseball.
Yes. What? Right. Oh, fighting ability?
Yeah, it's
yes.
like being an NHL enforcer.
Exactly, exactly. Another way he was described, Herman Schaefer, Herman was his real name, second baseman, principal prop of the Detroit infield, one of the few ball players whose value to a team is not shown by statistics. And then I love that it's followed up by says, in 1905, he led American League second baseman in putouts while hitting .244 with 9 triples. All right, great. All right, now we get to the fun stories here. The Prince, as he was often called because of his flashy showmanship on the field, always enjoyed performing in front of his hometown crowd. On May 24th, he turned in one of his most memorable games of his career. Schaefer was called on to pinch hit with 2 outs in the ninth and a runner on base, and his Tigers were down by a run. According to his teammate, Davy Jones, Germany announced to the crowd. This is as he's coming up to pinch hit. What did he announce to the crowd, Jake?
I'm here, bitches.
Pretty close. Pretty close. This is according to his teammate, Davy Jones.
He called a shot.
Oh, not only did he call a shot. He said, quote, ladies and gentlemen, you are now looking at Herman Schaefer, better known as Herman the Great, acknowledged by one and all to be the greatest pinch hitter in the world. I am now going to hit the ball into the left field bleachers. Thank you.
So what year is this?
This is 1906.
So he's the first Herman in baseball to call a shot.
What do you think he does? Facing Chicago's Doc White, Schaefer proceeded to?
Ground out to third.
Hit the first pitch into the left field bleachers for a game-winning homer. As he made his way around the diamond, he
took his pants off.
He supposedly slid into every base, announcing his progress as if it were a horse race as he went around.
Like, Schaefer rounds third.
Schaefer leads at the half, and so on. After hook sliding into home, he popped up, doffed his cap, and bowed and said, ladies and gentlemen, this concludes this afternoon's performance. I thank you for your kind attention. Incredible. Once while facing Rube Waddell, one of his favorite targets for verbal abuse, he reportedly launched a long home run and razzed the left-hander as he trotted around the bases. Carrying his bat with him, Schaefer, blank.
Schaefer, oh, like blank, like a verb?
What did he do? Yeah, while he carried his bat with him.
He rode it like a horse.
Mm. He pretended it was a gun, quote, shooting Rube as he moved from bag to bag.
Didn't Khalil Watson do that in the minor leagues and get suspended by the Marlins? Suspended?
Yes. Well, apparently it was more acceptable in 1907. Among Schaefer's other supposed antics, during a steady rain, he once appeared at the plate blank.
He once appeared at the plate in a towel.
Ooh, wearing rubber boots and a raincoat. So there you go. In both instances, and he was ejected, of course. He said he once ventured to the plate sporting a fake black mustache. In both instances, his outlandish behavior reportedly resulted in ejection.
Wait, he got ejected for wearing a fake mustache at the plate?
Yeah, I don't know what the big deal about that is. That one is very weird. All right. Now
Free Germany.
Free Germany, exactly. This is just, I mean, there's no way you're going to be able to guess this one. This is just the goofiest thing I've ever heard. Schaefer did not reserve his pranks for players alone. According to one story, umpire Jack Sheridan wandered into his favorite Chicago watering hole for a few drinks. After tilting back a few too many spirits, Sheridan fell asleep on his table located near a drainpipe. When Schaefer ambled in and saw the ump snoozing, he hopped upstairs and knelt on the floor. Cupping his hands, he moaned into the drainpipe, Jack Sheridan, your time has come. After Schaefer's creepy warning was repeated, Sheridan shook himself awake and streaked from the saloon, frightened sober. The incident so spooked Sheridan that he reportedly gave up drinking for a time. Later, Schaefer let the cat out of the bag during a game that Sheridan was working in New York. When Germany strolled to the plate, he couldn't resist saying, Jack Sheridan, your time has come. Sheridan's neck snapped toward Schaefer. You Dutch so-and-so, you're out of this game.
He ejected him?
Threw him out. Threw him out for reminding him that he once scared him while he was passed out drunk.
That's incredible, because if you're a fan at the game, you have zero context and you're like, why did he get ejected? Because he fell asleep in a bar like 6 years ago in Chicago.
Two more two more Germany Schaefer things. This one is I'm fascinated by. I'm curious about your opinion about this as a coach. All right. So I referred to this earlier. He was known for stealing first base.
Now,
when you think stealing first base, what do you think that means? Because this is now, when I started reading about this, this is not what I thought.
Drop third strike.
That is not what stealing first base means in this case. Okay. What stealing first base, what he would do, okay, follow this here. All right. August 4th, 1911, bottom of the ninth, Schaefer, there's a guy on third, okay, and there's a guy first and third. He tried to steal second and draw a throw home, right? We know this, double steal, draw a throw to second so that the guy from third can run home, okay? White Sox catcher Fred Pine didn't fall for the gambit, however. So Schaefer, now on second, took his lead toward the first base side and stole first on the subsequent pitch. He went back to first base so that he could try the double steal again.
He hit him with the control Z.
Okay. So the manager comes out to argue. He's arguing with the umpire. He goes back to second. This time, Schaefer does get caught on the rundown and his teammate, you know, runs home. So there you go. So basically, they ultimately ended up changing the rules that once you safely reach a base, you can no longer run in the other direction during a next play. You cannot run the bases in reverse. And that was because of how often he would try to go back to first to attempt the double steal again. But to me, I love this because it's like, how much of the advantage, like, is, as a coach, I'm curious, is it more of an advantage to just have second and third or to try the double steal where you can get the guy home from third?
Well, it depends on the game situation, right? Like, if you need that runner to score and your hitter sucks, there are plays that you can run where you have the guy on first fall down. There's one where you can fake an injury, right? Mm-hmm. You're running to second and you come up with a bum leg and then, you know. But
so it's interesting though, right? Like that you would want to go back is just so funny.
I like that they outlawed the control Z because I would definitely have tried that immensely.
There you go. Schaefer continued to fine-tune his crazy antics as a player and a coach. Umpire Silk O'Loughlin chased him from a game in Chicago for blank in the coach's box.
For smoking a cigar.
Eating popcorn. Very close. And Schaefer also began to perform tricks like tightrope walking the foul line and using two bats to row across the grass.
This guy was basically like the Harlem Globetrotters of baseball.
Correct, correct. While he enjoyed drawing laughter, Schaefer defended his comedic coaching as an important to team success. Is humorous coaching of value to a team? I think so. It is valuable for two reasons. Keeps our fellows in good spirits, and it sometimes distracts the opposing players. I guess Clark Griffith thinks so also, for he encourages me in my tomfoolery. Schaefer told the Sporting News in 1912. So there you go. That is Germany Schaefer. Eventually was hired by a scout. Tragically died of a like brain hemorrhage while he was on a train on a scouting trip when he was just 42. So that was very sad. But yeah, I mean, he was eulogized by a Detroit sports writer. Germany Schaefer was the soul of baseball itself with all its sorrows and joys. The born troubadour of the game.
Mm. So
there you go. Germany Schaefer. The dude was an absolute goof. Thank you for participating in this week's edition of Deadball Mad Libs. Thank you to Chris Tyler for producing this episode of Baseball Barbiecast. Thank you to Fernando Tatis Jr. for continuing to be more than interesting enough to talk about on a pod. And we will be back later this week with a pod to be determined. Maybe we will have some of our free agent all-stars signing and giving us some moves to talk about. Maybe not. But until then, thank you all for listening to this episode of Baseball Barbiecast, and we will talk to you soon.
SiriusXM Podcasts.